It's 50 years since the first James Bond movie came out. You probably heard that mentioned on the television or on the radio during the week. It was Dr. No with Sean Connery. I remember it well. I don't know about you, but I've seen a few of the Bond movies, and one of the most exciting scenes in a Bond movie is when the hero gets captured. And you know he's about to die, or not. And I've got a vivid image in my mind of Sean Connery being fastened to the bed of a laser cutting machine with his legs spread out in front of him and the beam of the laser gradually inching its way along the bed, moving its way towards him. Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. More recently, Daniel Craig, sitting naked on a dining chair from which the seat had been removed, and his torturer standing in front of him with a thick rope knotted at the end, beginning to swing it so that James Bond's imagination could only begin to wonder what might happen if that rope was swung underneath him. Recently, perhaps more seriously, a more serious film that Pat and I watched on the television. So it's an even older film than any of the James Bond ones. Carve Her Name with Pride, about a British agent in the Second World War, Violetta Jabot, who went to work with the French Resistance. And she was successful for some time, but eventually she was arrested by the Gestapo. And they said, well, who are you? And she insisted on using her French cover name, but they wanted to know who she really was, because they knew she was a British agent. Who are you? What is your name? And in the end, she was shot with some other agents as spies. And that's actually the kind of thing that's going on in this evening's reading. Because we've read about an interrogation and torture. That's what it is. The interrogation starts with Pilate asking Jesus, "Are you the King of the Jews?" There's the question. Now, Jesus has already been interrogated by the Jewish leaders, by the Sanhedrin, and the main charge was his claim to be the Christ. We haven't read that, but just to fill you in on the last few verses of the previous chapter. The high priest, verse 63, said to Jesus, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." They wanted to know if that's what Jesus was claiming. The Jews were waiting for the Christ. They were waiting for this great leader to come and bring God's deliverance to them. And they had various titles for him, but they all kind of coalesced into one person. Christ, Messiah. Well, those two words are synonymous, really. They both mean anointed. Christ is a kind of Greek word, and Messiah a Hebrew word. Anointed. The anointed one. They expected that when this person came, he would be anointed like a king, like our own sovereign is at her coronation. The queen in 1953 was anointed with oil, and that was a sign of God's favor upon her and God's choosing of her. The high priest used the title Son of God as an equivalent for Messiah. And that title had its origins way back in the Old Testament times. There are a number of places where you can see where this idea of Son of God comes from. There was a promise made to David by the prophet Nathan that one of his sons would be a son of God who would reign forever. That's in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Now Jesus acknowledged these titles. He didn't flatly deny that he was that person. But interestingly enough, in that interrogation with the Jewish leaders, Jesus preferred a different title, which is Son of Man. Verse 64. "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied, "but I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." And that title that Jesus seemed to like comes from the prophecy of Daniel, where Daniel says, "I looked, and in my vision at night, there before me was one like a son of man coming in the clouds of heaven, and he approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence." Jesus liked that title and saw himself fulfilling that prophecy. So Messiah, Christ, Son of God, Son of Man, Jesus had accepted these titles, but the Sanhedrin obviously believed that his claim was false, and therefore to claim these things was blasphemy. So the next step was to get the Romans to execute him. The Sanhedrin itself didn't have the legal authority to carry out executions, although we know that they sometimes trespassed over that boundary somewhat. For example, the stoning of Stephen was an execution carried out without any permission from the Romans, but they weren't really supposed to do that. And the Sanhedrin wanted to make sure that this one was really legal, that this one would really stick. And so they wanted the Romans to do it for them. So they took Jesus to Pilate, and they had to decide what the charge should be. If they said to Pilate, "This man claims to be the Messiah, this man claims to be the Christ, this man claims to be the Son of God," Pilate would just say, "Okay, fair enough, take him off and deal with him by your religious courts." But what they did is they translated it into a title that really means the same thing, but Pilate would have to sit up and take notice. Because, of course, the Messiah is going to be the King of the Jews. So Jesus is claiming to be that. And Pilate can't ignore that one if Jesus is claiming to be the King of the Jews. And it conveys the gist of the other titles, but it also suggests a direct threat to Roman power. So that was the charge that the Sanhedrin brought against Jesus. So that was the first question that Pilate asked Jesus: "Are you the King of the Jews?" So what did Jesus say? "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. That's what the NIV says. But actually, it's not really as simple as that, because the New Testament Greek, "sulegēs," means "you are saying it. You're saying that." And I looked in a number of different translations to see how they rendered this, and the Good News Bible says, "so you say." The Authorized Version, the old traditional translation, said, "thou sayest." RSV, "you have said so." NEB, New English Bible, "the words are yours." And I like the Message translation, "if you say so." Which is really actually conveys the gist of what Jesus is saying. "I don't want to claim this. If you say that, fair enough, okay. You can believe that if you like." So actually, obviously, the NIV here is a little bit misleading because it's too positive. It's the most positive of all those translations, isn't it? And none of the other ones suggest that Jesus answered the question so directly as to say, yes, it is as you say. So as you can see, the question of what Jesus said is actually a bit complicated. It's just as well, actually, that we've got John's Gospel here, because John gives us a much fuller account of Jesus' interrogation by Pilate. And Pilate says in John chapter 18, verse 33, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "Is that your own idea, or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you've done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." With this, Pilate went out again to the Jews and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him." So once Jesus had explained that, Pilate realized there wasn't really any threat to the Roman authority. If that's what Jesus meant by being a king, that he was bringing heavenly rule and heavenly authority to earth. So we can see that Jesus hesitated to give an unequivocal answer to Pilate's question, because the title King of the Jews was one way of referring to the Messiah, but the meaning that Pilate would understand was completely different from what Jesus understood of his mission. Pilate would be thinking of a military leader like Judas Maccabeus 200 years before, who'd actually rebelled successfully against the Greek Empire. That's the kind of Messiah that Pilate would have in mind, and Jesus didn't want to say anything positive about that. Jesus couldn't simply say yes to the question. But once Pilate realized that Jesus wasn't really claiming to be a military commander in that sense, he tried to avoid having Jesus executed. And he hoped he might be able to enlist the support of the crowd. I think Pilate would have thought, to start with, okay, these nasty religious leaders from the Sanhedrin have bought Jesus. They're obviously against him. But all these other folk that have gathered to listen, they're probably in favour of Jesus. After all, they were all shouting welcomes to him just a few days ago when he came into Jerusalem. So if I could just get them to exert their influence, we might be able to get him released. Now, it was the governor's custom at the feast to release a prisoner chosen by the crowd. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when the crowd had entered, Pilate asked them, "Which one do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew it was out of envy that they had handed Jesus over to him. It's an interesting little bit about the text of the Bible here, and that is that in verse 16, just a few manuscripts, not very many, and they're quite late, have Jesus Barabbas. And if that was right, if his name was Jesus as well, it would be an interesting coincidence, wouldn't it? We have Jesus Barabbas and Jesus Bar Joseph up against each other, because Bar means son of. The fact that they would both be called Jesus isn't that much of a coincidence, though, because Jesus is the Greek form of Joshua, which would have been probably one of the most popular names for Jewish boys at that time. So he might well have been called that. While Pilate was sitting on the judge's seat, his wife sent him this message: "Don't have anything to do with that innocent man, for I've suffered a great deal today in a dream because of him." Now, Pilate's trying to wriggle out of making a choice here. He knew Jesus didn't deserve to be executed, and his wife's message probably encouraged him even more to see if he could get out of it, get out of having to condemn Jesus. So he's hoping that this idea of asking the crowd to choose between Barabbas and Jesus will get Jesus released. But unfortunately, his idea misfired. He misinterpreted the mood of the crowd and how much influence their leaders would have over them. Perhaps they were afraid to contradict the idea of the leaders, the Sanhedrin. But one way or another, they all started shouting, "No, we want Barabbas released, and Jesus can be crucified." "Which of the two do you want me to release? Barabbas. So what do you want me to do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all answered, "Crucify him." "Why? What crime has he committed?" asked Pilate. You can hear the frustration in his voice, can't you? He doesn't really think Jesus is guilty of anything that deserves punishment. Certainly not deserves death. And yet he can't get the crowd to agree with this. "What crime has he committed?" But they shouted all the louder, "Crucify him." So then Pilate does this rather pathetic gesture. He took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd. "I am innocent of this man's blood," he said. "It's your responsibility." That was the action of a morally weak man, wasn't it? He couldn't really duck the responsibility by this gesture of washing his hands. It was still his decision, and he couldn't get out of it. But he didn't want it to look as if it was his decision, because he knew it wasn't the right decision. He knew it wasn't morally right. "It's your responsibility," says Pilate, pointing to the crowd. And all the people answered, "Let his blood be on us and on our children." "Okay," said the crowd, "you don't want to take responsibility, Pilate. We'll take responsibility. Let his blood be on us and on our children." Those are shocking words, aren't they? I don't know if you remember a few years ago when Mel Gibson made that film, The Passion of the Christ. He decided, it was quite rather an interesting decision, he decided that all the people, Jesus and Pilate and all the others, would speak in the language that they would have spoken, the original languages. So you hear Aramaic and you hear Latin from Pilate, and it's interesting. But of course you've got subtitles, and in Britain we had English subtitles at the bottom. All over the world there are different subtitles. When a lobby of Jewish leaders got to hear what Mel Gibson was doing, and they managed to get a showing of the film, they said, "You're not putting that in. Let his blood be on us and on our children. We're not having that." And Mel Gibson agreed to a compromise. The people still say that, but there aren't any subtitles. So you don't know what they're saying unless you can speak Aramaic. But that is what they're saying. And it's a terrible thing to have said. We wouldn't want to pin the responsibility for Jesus' death on Jewish people and all their children down the generations. We wouldn't, but some people have, haven't they? And that's a dreadful thing to have done. So Pilate released Barabbas, and he had Jesus flogged and handed him over to be crucified. A dangerous criminal was released back into the community because of Pilate's foolish idea to let the crowd choose between Barabbas and Jesus. Jesus is flogged. In just a couple of words, Matthew tells us something that would have been a long, painful procedure. Pieces of bone or metal would be fastened into the thongs of the implement of torture. So it wasn't just a question of getting slapped by some gentle strings or something. This was an instrument that could kill. And interestingly enough, in Mel Gibson's film, Pilate says to the centurion who's going to supervise the flogging, he says, "Punish him, but don't kill him." In other words, he knew there would be a risk that he would be killed by the flogging. Luke and John, in their Gospels, both relay that Pilate hoped the flogging would appease the crowd, and that when they saw the damage done, the pain that had been inflicted, they would then feel compassion and have mercy and say, "Oh, well, that's enough. You don't need to do any more." Luke writes, "As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will punish him and then release him." That's Pilate's intention. And John says, "Then Pilate took Jesus and had him flogged. And then once more Pilate came out and said to the Jews, 'Look, I am bringing him out to you to let you know that I find no basis for a charge against him.'" But in the end, that didn't work. And the crowd were not satisfied with the flogging. They demanded to have the whole thing. They demanded that he be crucified. And that is next week's story. So we'll stop there.